Oh, right now.
Jones! Build that on me, baby! Because Davy Crockett, right here, is the best black athlete in the world!
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown Estate in front of a live studio audience.
Sit, Ubu, sit. Good dog.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 42 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson, and today we'll be taking a look at the National Wrestling Alliance, the NWA, although it was pretty much all JCP under the NWA banner at this point. March 29th, 1986, episode of Worldwide Wrestling. So this should be a lot of fun. This is the earliest NWA show that I've covered, and they were going through a very hot period here early in 1986, gearing up for what would be the first Crockett Cup tournament. First, let me get a few plugs in. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod, and at Facebook, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Not much from Twitter this week other than to say I do, in fact, wish that I had just done a podcast about the movie Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, because it is by far the best Thanksgiving movie there is. So I'm not going to do that because that's not the goal of this show, at least for right now. So if you want to hear a podcast on that, you'll want to check out one called Wood in the Bone. They just did a podcast on Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, and I give them a shout out because one of those guys helped me with audio as I was starting this podcast very early on, so why the heck not? So I hope you all here in the United States had a happy Thanksgiving. My Thanksgiving started with a 5K run for the second consecutive year, which I finished in 27 minutes 34 seconds, which was way better than my time from last year, almost a 4-minute improvement. So this goes to show that running 2 miles twice a week can really help out. And while the results on the website of the New Hampshire Fisher Cats 5K had me in like 82nd place in my division, I'm saying that I am really in first place in my division, because if you break it down by my weight, my age, and how much I drank the night before, I think all those factors should go in to considering what division I'm in. But to tie it back to wrestling, 27-34, I thought, let's compare that with some recent WrestleMania matches and see how my time lines up with those. It was 2 minutes and 31 seconds less than Shane McMahon versus The Undertaker at WrestleMania 32, although it felt like about 45 minutes less than what that match was, because it felt like it never was going to end. And it was 3 minutes and 16 seconds less than the Undertaker versus Triple H wank fest at WrestleMania 28. Oh, the end? It's the end of an era, everybody. And here are two guys who are going to have prominent matches on the next 5 WrestleManias. So, yes, what an end of era that was there. So I'll put aside the snark for now. And so I'm hosting Thanksgiving last week. The family comes over, my two nephews, 8 years old, and kind of stuff them in the basement there so that they can run around or whatever. One of them hit the other with like my giant inflatable Stanley Cup that I bought in 2011, hit him in the eye. So I had to give him a good talking to after that. Then I come down a little later, and they have wrestling on the TV. I'm like, how did you get that on there? And he's like, oh, I got it through YouTube. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, I'm aware you can watch wrestling through YouTube. Like, what are you watching? Like, we're trying to find John Cena versus The Undertaker. Like, okay, all right. I'm not sure that that ever happened. Of course, apparently it did in 2003 or something, because that's the answer for everything. Like, oh, I don't know if that ever happened. Oh, it happened in 2003 on an episode of SmackDown. That's generally how it goes. But they were watching a clip from, it had to be like a 1999 Raw, the one where it's Rock and Undertaker and Kane are all there, and it's where Earl Hebner comes down to the ring and decides he's not going to get in, and he throws up his hands. So I think this might have been during the official strike that they had going on at that time. A little kind of a brief, forgettable Attitude Era storyline. And they were fooling around with my big gold belt, which is fine, just as long as they don't break it, because I don't think I could replace it. Besides, this is the cheap Mattel plastic toy or whatever. So it's kind of interested in seeing that. They, at age 8, probably would never get into my podcast at all, which is for the best. Even though I do try to keep it clean here, there sometimes I can't help myself with certain references, so might need a little older sentimentality to get into that. So how about that NWA worldwide music during this time period? The one in 1988, which I did, I believe it was episode 25, NWA from 88, so 2.5 years after this, the music is very, very different. Here, I cut off the music right before it goes to this disco beat, which all I could think of every time it kept going to commercial and playing like the disco part is Dusty Rhodes wearing the John Travolta outfit and doing the point diagonally to the sky thing. I like to put Dusty Rhodes in all sorts of weird situations and imagine him doing things. So Jim Crockett Promotions is running hot in early 1986, coming off Starrcade 85, which, despite the screwy ending to the main event where you have Dusty winning on the pay-per-view and then it getting overturned a little bit after that, things were still running good, drawing great hot crowds across the board. You had star power up and down the card. At this time in 86, you're getting the start of Ric Flair and Ricky Morton having a little bit of a singles feud with the training bra and the taunting and then rubbing his nose in cement, the Horseman doing that to Ricky Morton. Just really good stuff. Magnum TA as the U.S. champion going against the Koloffs, in particular Nikita. They're starting out their series around this time. Really the last big program of Magnum TA's career before his accident. You know, Tully and Dusty in what was a never-ending war, it seems, over titles and money and baby doll and this and that kind of stuff. So a lot going on. And then further down the card, you have the never-ending war between the Boogie Woogie Man, Jimmy Valiant, and Paul Jones and his army, which he had just really started the army branding not too long before this to kind of give it more, I guess, of an edge. But that's a lot further down the card, but still very, very hot as Jimmy Valiant, despite my, like, I don't quite understand why people are going crazy for this guy who looks like he's having a seizure at all times. Just, you know, not really understanding what his popularity is based on, but it is certainly fun to watch. You have your tag team champions, the Midnight Express, who are on this show, and their issue at this time is being really pissed off that they are not the number one seed in the Crockett Cup tournament, which you can do storylines just based on simple stuff like that. And in the mid-80s, particularly in NWA and in the UWF as well, and this is probably something of a Jim Ross influence down in the old Mid-South territory, is the whole, we feel like we should be ranked higher. Of course, the Midnight Express were the World Tag Team Champions, so the thought is, well, of course they should be the number one seed in the upcoming Crockett Cup, which was a commercial tape release for later years. Crockett Cup 86 seems a little bit harder to come by in terms of seeing the footage. I have not seen much, if any, of it. I may have been watching Crockett Cup 87 and thought I was seeing 86 or something. This was obviously not on pay-per-view at the time, but it got me thinking about the whole concept of pay-per-view in Jim Crockett Promotions. We all know because we just celebrated the 30-year anniversary of the Survivor Series, and you have that event partly created to offset Starrcade coming to pay-per-view finally in 1987. And Vince McMahon had this notion that, well, I put on WrestleMania 3, so clearly only I should be able to do pay-per-view wrestling in the United States, which, you know, is pretty absurd and sounds like an antitrust lawsuit waiting to happen. And I don't want to really get into the whole maneuverings of Vince from an antitrust perspective, but it makes me think of Crockett in 86 not trying something on pay-per-view, because it would have been the perfect time to try and do that as they were expanding their reach into Central States and partnerships with the UWF, because we saw the call-offs on UWF television in the late spring with the, they put the flag on the cowboy angle as covered in an early episode, episode 21 of Greetings from Allentown. Do check that out in the archives. Why did they not go to pay-per-view? Because it was the perfect time for the promotion to do that because of how hot they were running, and also because pay-per-view was not so beholden to Vince McMahon in 1986, because WrestleMania was only on a very, very, very limited basis. And the first real widespread pay-per-view that they had done was the Wrestling Classic in November of 85. Then you get to WrestleMania the following year, which was very disappointing in terms of what they were expecting in terms of a buy rate from the cable company's perspective. So if you threw the Great American Bash, let's say one show of the Great American Bash on pay-per-view in 1986, and even if you don't try to go national with it, if you try to go greater regional, where you include Texas, you include some of the territories that they've expanded into, even up to Ohio because of the Georgia Championship Wrestling presence there and kind of the legacy of that, so watching the Crockett territory, they would have done a lot better there and at least had a foot in the door. Because anything they would try to do after WrestleMania 3, it seems, was just going to be too late. And they just really missed their timing on it. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact, and Tony Schiavone talked about this on his podcast, is that Jim Crockett Jr. was not exactly the most dynamic businessman. He wasn't very good at dealing with the boys in terms of money disputes and that sort of thing. And he ran his company quite selfishly in 88, you know, with the Dallas office, having an office in Dallas, even though his company is based out of North Carolina, just because he wanted to be in Dallas and flying airplanes all over the place, flying to Vegas for a stopover for a day just to party for no real reason at all, but bleeding the company dry, as it turned out. And I say all this not to state that Jim Crockett was a stupid man. He wasn't by any means. But when you take all the wrestling promoters around the country who had territories fail for one reason or another, like a Vern Gagne, a Fritz, all those guys, it is a, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And Jimmy Crockett is the one-eyed man in this case. Now on the show today, we have a lot packed in here in terms of promos, in addition to the one big angle, which I cannot wait to get to with Pez Whatley and Jimmy Valiant. Just trust me, I've been waiting the whole time I've been doing this show. I've been waiting to do this very segment, and there's the very real possibility that the Pez Whatley, Jimmy Valiant segment may run 45 minutes just on its own. Perhaps I should have released it as its own show, like I did with the DiBiase special. In addition to the NWA having a ton of promos on the show, there is actually a few local promos for a show in Roanoke in early April. We do have Ronnie Garvin, Hands of Stone, is in action. So I am very anxious to see David Crockett's reaction to a Ron Garvin match, because some of those that you see on TBS, he can get a little overexcited. Arn Anderson is in singles competition, and he's the television champion at this point in time. And Jimmy Garvin is in action as well. This is well before his Freebirds days. And we get a Midnight Express squash match. Unfortunately, it's not one from around this time that was much more famous, which I'll tell the story of when we get to the Midnight Express match. And of course, all the big dudes are on this show with promos. Dusty's going to check in, Tully Blanchard, and so on and so forth. So, with all that in mind, we might as well just jump right into the show. I know it's Kiri and not Kyrie, but, you know, I just want to take a moment to complain that they don't make enough Kyrie Irving t-shirts in kids' sizes, since he's very popular with kids around here, and apparently even my nephew on Long Island wanted a Kyrie Irving Celtics shirt, but they're very difficult to find in, like, the, you know, you have the Celtics logo on the front and Irving 11 on the back. I don't know. Just I can't think of any other way I would get that complaint out. And so get your act together, NBA properties or whatever the hell you're called. You had Tony Schiavone and David Crockett hosting the show, and they run everything down. Crockett Cup is on its way. They're going to be announcing the 24 teams that'll be taking part, although I believe they've already announced it on the other show. But as I've said on earlier Greetings from Allentown episodes, They operated in completely different universes sometimes, the Championship Wrestling show and Worldwide, and sometimes they would link up and oftentimes they would not. But we get a promo to start out here with one of the more forgettable characters in Jim Crockett Promotions. This would be Joel Coltrane, Nighthawk, as he's otherwise known. I think I wrote Joel Colborne in my notes, in my hockey-addled mind here, center for the Calgary Flames. Like, this is how forgettable this guy is. And if you're wondering why he was so... if you listen to him, you will understand why he never really progressed too much further outside of this little window in the spring of 1986. They refer to him as one of the best talents in the world, which, my ass. I mean, I have not watched many of this guy's matches, if I've watched any of his matches. And in fact, on Cage Match, there's really not too much on him. They have him with the Rock and Rolls beating the Midnights and Jim Cornette at an Omni show, which actually was on March 30th of 86. And he's picking up wins over Teho Khan of Paul Jones's Army. But he loses to the ancient Baron von Raschke on a house show. And then loses to Arn Anderson. And that's pretty much it for him. His most memorable thing would be his role in the Jimmy Valiant-Pez Watley dispute, which I'll get to coming up here. But this promo here, goodness gracious, he's completely babbling.
Yes, sir, Mr. Crockett, I tell you, you know, the Worldwide Wrestling is a good opportunity to be here, and I'm proud to be here to represent my race and all the good fans around the country. And I tell you, right here, these are the best athletes in the world. And
all right, I'm going to have to stop you right there, Coltrane. You're here to represent your race? That's a really weird sort of thing to say. I don't know. I feel like race is getting interjected here where it doesn't necessarily need to. Yes, he is an African-American man, but I don't see what that has to do with it, unless it's a oblique reference to the unfortunate practice done by some territories of, well, we only have one black guy here, and he fills that role, and that's all we're going to have. And, of course, Pez Watley is already there, and they pair those two guys together as friends, because in wrestling circles, it seems that they always want to believe that, well, if the two black guys are not fighting each other, then clearly they must be friends. It's not like they can exist in separate worlds. Anyway, let's let Coltrane bring this home.
I've had the opportunity to serve my country and do a lot of serving around the country, and I'll just tell you, this right here is where it is. And if you want to speak in a sense of great athletes, I know people make a big deal about that, but in that sense, you just have to, you know, you couldn't mention good athletes. I've mentioned Magnum PA. I think Magnum PA is one of the best in the country. You know, he's like full thoroughbred. You know, in talking to Dusty Rhodes not long ago, you know, Dusty told me, he said, you can't take a mule to the Kentucky Derby and expect to win. And that's about on the sense that this is.
All right, Nighthawk, you know, you're talking about everybody else, but let me tell you about this young man.
So David tries to cut him off there to save him from himself. But then the old Nighthawk, he's going to try to bring it home again, but he's having trouble steering that ship.
Well, you know, amateur and weightlifting, that's one thing. But, you know, doggone, in the ring, you can bench press bodies in the ring, but that don't make you the best in here. You know, these guys are going to be coming out, and they're going to be rough and tough. And, you know, I guess that's what I'm all about. One-on-one, you know, sure. We just throw them in the hat and see what it's about, you know.
All right, thank you very much.
You gotta love a guy who's saying that he's not the best on a promo there. I know maybe he's trying to be modest, but holy crap, that is one of the worst promos that I've covered on this show. I don't think anything's going to top Dr. Death talking for 3 straight minutes and then looking for Jim Ross to bail him out. And even JR wasn't there to bail out Dr. Death. So Joel Coltrane doesn't even get the award for the worst promo in Greetings from Allentown history. I feel like it's a good idea to put Spanish Flea under a promo like that. It makes it a lot more bearable when you have some background music as Coltrane is just babbling on about whatever. Now we got somebody who most certainly does not babble on, and it is the star of our show today, Mr. Pez Whatley, taking on the Golden Terror, who's a guy that you would see on Jim Crockett shows all the time in the mid-1980s. Man's name behind the mask is Ben Alexander. He unfortunately passed away at the age of 51 back in 2002. And at some point in his career, he was main eventing shows in South Africa. So there is that. Unfortunately, I think that was probably the South Africa with apartheid. So not so good there that he was willing to play Sun City. So Pez Whatley. You're drawn to his first name immediately, and that makes him instantly memorable, Pez. That's actually short for Pezavan. So Pez is the shortened version of it. And Pezavan sounds like a prescription drug that you would hear, like a 45-second reading of sound effects as the 58-year-old white guy is walking around smiling in the kitchen with his wife. Could be erectile dysfunction, could be acid reflux. Really, if I ever created a prescription drug, I probably would name it Pezavan in honor of Pez Whatley. And then immediately you also think of the candy Pez as well. Now, about a year and a half ago, the site mentalfloss.com did an article that was like 10 facts about Pez candy and how it became popular in the 80s and 90s. So let me just go through at least some of them that were interesting to me. One is that Pez were originally anti-smoking mints, which is hilarious because came along in 1927, or at least the idea for Pez, when approximately 130% of the population was smoking. I know later on, and that's an approximation, 1950s and 60s, I peg it about 130%. And that's really just because of Jackie Gleason. He makes up that extra 30% because he smoked so much over and above the 100%. Two, the first Pez were round. You usually think of them as little rectangular tablets, but in the beginning, they were actually round. Also in the beginning of Pez, the ads for them were a bit racy. They would have women doing seductive things with the little bar of Pez that they would come in and that you know of to put in the dispensers. the dispenser was actually a huge goal of the company in creating it. So that was something that they had all along, but it wouldn't be for a while until you would see those dispensers with like the heads on them and all that. In fact, Pez didn't even come to the United States until the 1950s. Now, Whatley was born in 1951, and Pez did not come to the United States until 1953. So it's not like he was named after the candy. This was just a complete coincidence of whatever. Because when you think of Pez Whatley, you immediately think of the candy. There's a little thing here in how the candy is made. It's like high pressure, whatever. They had plant-flavored Pez at one point. They're chlorophyll-flavored candies, whatever. This is a lot of Pez talk here.
Chlorophyll? More like borophyll.
Thanks, Billy, for keeping me on track here. Back to Pez Whatley, who, of course, he would become an enhancement talent in the WWF in 1990 and 91. You'd see him often opening house shows and occasionally on TV as well. There's some wrestling early on in this, a leg takedown. Pez Whatley is okay in the ring. He was never anything too special. Obviously, if he became an enhancement guy, he could sell at least a little bit. But he gets out of a waist lock with kind of a weird-looking headlock. Not entirely the most graceful thing in the world. He teases the unmasking of the Golden Terror. Another one of those where they unmask him and nobody actually knows who he is. And then he just covers up and runs to the back, as often might happen. Get an atomic drop as well, because it is the 1980s. And Whatley runs the ropes at one point. Terror drops down, and Whatley just sort of stops. And Whatley grabs him in a side headlock and takes him over and almost gets a three count. In fact, the referee might have been a little slow there and could have gotten a pin off a side headlock. I've never seen a match end on a side headlock. If you ever have seen a usual squash match or whatever end on a side headlock, I would like to see that, just to see how that actually worked. Hip toss, another side headlock takeover. This is not the most dynamic stuff, as I said. Like I said, he's perfectly fine. He's not horrible in the ring. Terror gets a little offense there, but he misses a knee. And Whatley struts around again because, you know, that's what he does at this time. And he gets whipped to the corner, though, but he jumps up on the second turnbuckle. And instead of doing the head fake, as I believe we've seen Shawn Michaels do on an earlier show, he decides to just jump off for the crossbody and picks up the win that way. Again, like I said, not too dynamic. He wasn't getting a whole lot of reaction, except for when he would do the little strut and shuck a jive thing in the ring. So I think Pez, he's going through this match, and he's probably having a crisis of self-confidence. Not quite to the level of Paul Orndorff. He's not calling in Gary Spivey. But perhaps some changes have to be made going forward. And oh boy, would those changes be happening.
Ladies and gentlemen, with me now, J.J. Dillon, the National Heavyweight Champion, Tully Blanchard.
You know, David, I got a letter this week from a fan up in Anchorage, Alaska, and they were asking, since Tully Blanchard acquired the National Heavyweight Championship, has it really changed his lifestyle? And I think the question could better be answered if you were to ask the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, if the lack of the national title has changed his lifestyle. Because I used to open up the sporting news and I'd read a little comment in there about what restaurant the national champion, now former champion, Dusty Rhodes, had dinner in.
Okay, JJ, I'm going to stop you right there, because there are certain things I want to call attention to in what you just said. First of all, how would the guy from Anchorage, Alaska be watching the TV? I'm pretty sure the TBS wasn't all the way up there, although perhaps satellite dish, and that's what I'm missing here. So maybe that's easily explainable. I think up in a place like Alaska, satellite dishes were more of a thing relative to the rest of the country in the mid-1980s. So, all right, maybe I'll let that go. But my dad was a longtime subscriber to the Sporting News, and maybe you're just saying the Sporting News as referring to the sports section of the newspaper, but you said the Sporting News. I don't recall a single time that great institution, the baseball Bible, as it was called, them ever reporting on where Dusty Rhodes went to eat. In fact, as you look at Dusty's physique through the 1980s, they would have really had trouble keeping up with where Dusty was going to eat and all the restaurants and that sort of thing. I like J.J. Dillon overall. I really liked his book, and I covered it in a 3 or 4 part series on my blog, section309.com, which is not going away. It's been re-upped for another year, and I wish I could find more time to write stuff on that. Like the J.J. Dillon book, and maybe someday I'll finish the Bob Backlund book if I ever get around to that. I have listened to J.J. Dillon's podcast, and I really wanted to like it because Rich Puccini, I really liked him as Rich Brennan broadcasting NXT, and he got a really unfair shake from WWE. But there's something about Dillon's voice in the podcast format that just doesn't really appeal to me all that much. He came off much better in his book, which is a little bit older. I believe that came out in 2005. Although, really, in the course of J.J. Dillon's career, there's not a whole lot that he could add since 2005, since the majority of his career was in the 70s and 80s. He's a star up in the Maritimes. He spent a lot of time up there, and it was kind of fun to read about that because it's not something that, you know, a casual fan would ever hear about, is wrestling up in the Maritimes of Canada. Tully had actually just won the title from Dusty Rhodes, and he's got the belt with him, the national heavyweight title, which later in 86 would get merged with the U.S. title, which was held by Nikita Koloff at that time. He beat Wahoo McDaniel, singular McDaniel, not plural. It's not Wahoo McDaniels, it's Wahoo McDaniel. And Tully, he's wearing a white hat here, which really bugs me, because when it comes to heels in the 1980s, he is the ultimate black hat sort of guy. So he's wearing a white hat here, which is extremely confusing to me, or whatever. And this Dusty feud is ongoing and would be both real life and in-ring. And in fact, Dusty probably had better in-ring chemistry with Tully Blanchard than he did with Ric Flair, in my opinion. The Flair-Dusty thing, because those are both two tippy-top guys. But with Tully, the matches that they had, like it's Starrcade 86, so this would go on for a while. By the time you get to 1988, it's mostly behind-the-scenes stuff where Tully is so unhappy about Dusty still being the booker and all that sort of stuff. Tully makes a rather cryptic comment here, given what would happen to him in the coming years.
But you know what I like best? Dusty Rhodes comes out here, you got to deal with the dealer. Well, Dusty Rhodes, I have dealt with the dealer.
That's no jive from Tully either. In fact, it would get confirmed 3 years later that, in fact, yes, Tully Blanchard has dealt with his share of dealers through the years. I'm not asking for another chance. I just want to know why. There's no easy way out. There's no shortcut. A lot of older people, and I'm thinking Mike Francesa on WFAN in New York, who was recently trashing Rocky IV, who just doesn't get the whole oeuvre of that movie. And much the same it's been for me with the Boogie Woogie Man, Jimmy Valiant, who is up next, taking on Ron Rossi, who, not too much to say about him, although he his wrestling data record, I think, is something like 0-47. And he doesn't even have a cage match link, which I find to be very disrespectful for a guy who was on the TVs in the mid-80s, much like the Golden Terror. Fortunately, he passed away at his home in South Carolina at the age of 62 just this past July. So Jimmy Valiant, who is still kicking, still going strong at age 75, just this lengthy career managed by almost every legendary manager you can think of in the business. So I guess Freddie Blassie wasn't on the list, but, you know, whatever. WWF Hall of Famer, which is weird because you don't really associate him with that promotion after 1979. He's more of a Worldwide Wrestling Federation guy. He was in WWA, managed by Bobby Heenan at that point, one of the biggest stars in Memphis, and of course in the NWA here, while he's not battling for the world title, he's a significant presence all the way up through 1987 and 88, just in this battle, this never-ending battle with Paul Jones in what would eventually become his army. Valiant is the kind of guy that I've come around on mainly as a function of doing this show, because I'm watching wrestling slightly differently in putting together stuff for the podcast than I would in the past, where I would just kind of be looking for cool moves and stuff like that. Oh, was that a good match? Now I'm looking more for the silliness, the absurdities, the entertainment aspect of it all. And Jimmy Valiant really delivers on that with some of just the crazy stuff that he does. Now, this match here is really nothing. He just kind of runs over Rossi, knocks him over with a forearm, and then drops an elbow and gets a three count. So not a whole lot to speak of here. But his entertainment comes in a lot of the other stuff that he does in terms of his promo work, which is truly excellent. And speaking of promos, we have another one up here, which is Gorgeous Jimmy Garvin, who is in the midst of his feud with Wahoo McDaniel, and Precious is there too, and she's got the little aerosol thing spraying, because his thing was that everything smelled badly. I guess maybe you have a point if you're following Jimmy Valiant, although he's in the interview area. Jimmy Valiant sometimes looks like the guy, kind of guy who might not smell particularly good. So, Gorgeous Jimmy, who, you know, took a lot of crap on the Where the Big Boys Play podcast, and justifiably so for some of his later work in the Freebirds. It's not exactly dynamic, there's that word again, or anything like that. But I like this promo because he goes in there and he's very determined to do a bit here. So he takes a telephone, but with this being 1986, it's a corded telephone. It's, you know, one of the ones with like the hook on the top and all that, and it is a push dial, thankfully. It's not a rotary phone. Garvin's bit here is that he is calling up Wahoo McDaniel directly, but he wants Crockett to actually make the call, because what he says is that Wahoo won't come to the phone or won't answer the call if he knows that it's Jimmy Garvin. So he's doing a thing now where, you know, obviously you can only hear one side of the conversation because it's not a speakerphone. Is that's part of the bit here, is he's probably just calling whatever, and he says that he will send $5,000 down to Wahoo to come down and sign a contract to face him. So now he's trying to say that Wahoo McDaniel, this big tough dude, is scared to face Gorgeous Jimmy Garvin, who then says, "Don't start crying, Wahoo." Which, so he's now telling us that Wahoo is crying in fear on this. It's really kind of a fun little bit here. I wasn't expecting, when I saw the rundown of the show and I saw a Jimmy Garvin promo with Precious, I was not really expecting this to run the way it did. And Garvin actually kind of sells it as if Wahoo is on the line there. And he kind of does, you know, Wahoo hangs up on him. He's like, "Hello, hello." And the thing that I appreciate the most about this promo from Jimmy Garvin is that he didn't say Wahoo McDaniels. He said Wahoo McDaniel.
"I'd like to speak to Wahoo McDaniel, please. Yeah, this is Davy Crockett. I have to use your name, you know. If I use mine, he won't come to the phone."
"That's right. He's thinking, Gorgeous."
"He's doing what? Making mud pots in the back. It's okay. Go get him and tell him it's important. Okay, just a minute. He's coming. Wahoo! Yeah, hey, look, no, don't hang up, don't hang up. This is Gorgeous Jay. Listen, I'll send you $5,000, $5,000, plus I'll send a helicopter to pick you up if you can get down here and sign this contract with me, because we can't wait all day. The fans in the world want to know if you're really a coward like I say you are.
You gonna come?"
"No, don't start crying, Wahoo. It's not necessary to fall to pieces like that. No, no. Take it easy. Take a few deep breaths. Everything will be... All I want you to do is sign a contract to wrestle the greatest wrestler in the world. Yeah. Look, I know you've had a hard life. I know that, Wahoo, but the fact is this. They call you a legend around here. And by the way, that guy Magnum TA, well, Fast Eddie Vega, he's the one to give me this phone number. Yeah. Hello, hello?
What'd he do?
Hello?
I don't know what that was at the end about Eddie Vega. I couldn't quite figure out what that was. Because Magnum TA, that was the feud that Jimmy Garvin... they were ramping up for towards the end of 1986 when Magnum had his accident. I don't think it's entirely true that Magnum was on a course to face Ric Flair with the accident, because at the TV at the time, he and Garvin were kind of having promos against each other, so it seemed like it was heading in that direction, and then Magnum would probably move on to Flair at some point in 87. And then he and Precious kind of make out at the end there, which is kind of nice to see, given that she was at the Hall of Fame and they had been together for however many years, almost 50 years at that point. Nice to see a wrestling couple really make it over the decades. There are works of art that are classics in life. Some people prefer the classical works of Mozart. Other people, like me, prefer Midnight Express squash matches. And you get one here. They are taking on Gene Ligon and Tony Zane. They are the NWA World Tag Team Champions at this point. And as I had mentioned, they were very upset about not being the number one seed for the Crockett Cup. And I believe that they do have a case here. They had won the tag team titles from the Rock and Roll Express in February at the very little talked about Superstars on the Superstation. Kind of, it was a super show of sorts, kind of like a precursor to the Clash of the Champions, as it turned out. Now, unfortunately, in the annals of Midnight Express squash matches, one of the most famous happened on March 29th, 1986. Unfortunately, this match is not that one. As you see, this is the worldwide one, which is a little different from the World Championship Wrestling 605 Saturday Night one, which is the famous Midnight Express versus Wee Willie Wilkins and some other guy who is not very important, because it's Wee Willie Wilkins, who's this undersized guy who thought he was really hot stuff, because I guess he had brought a couple of bodybuilders with him, and he was no-selling some of the offense of Beautiful Bobby and Loverboy Dennis Condrey, which was a very big mistake, because then they started laying it in to him, and it's quite a scene there. And Wilkins, he kind of pops up and no-sells something near the end of the match, so I can't even imagine what went on backstage. It's probably a Jim Cornette rant about it somewhere. By the way, I love how Jim Cornette, I saw this on Twitter this morning as I'm recording this, told somebody to calm down and not to fly off the handle at Meltzer for something. Like, oh really? Jim Cornette is telling somebody else to calm down and be rational about something. That's just rich. This match, not exactly the Wee Willie Wilkins thing, as Eaton takes a backdrop and a bear hug early in the match from Tony Zane, which was kind of unnerving there, that they're taking a little bit of offense. Condrey is in, and Condrey, I'm starting to appreciate him a little bit more. I still prefer the Stan Lane version, because I think you can do more things with them, but Condrey is just a nasty looking dude. I mean, you need guys like that in wrestling. Maybe, yeah, he's called Loverboy, but not exactly the best looking dude in the world. I mean, Beautiful Bobby was never exactly beautiful himself. Eaton gets back and he's in control of things a bit more. Ligon gets in the ring now, and Condrey has him by the ropes, and they do the thing where Cornette is taunting him with the tag titles, and Ligon takes a swipe at him, which I thought was straight, like he's my cat when, you know, my cat doesn't want to get petted anymore. Eaton grabs his face and effectively just tries to tear his face off for a little bit, And Condry is wiping his face in the mat. So some cool heel work going on here. They're just cutting off the ring like crazy, but eventually Zayn does get back in because the Midnights were always equal opportunity beatdown guys. They weren't just going to beat down the one guy. Once they were through with it, but if they didn't feel like wrapping it up, they would just throw him across the ring and let him tag out so that they could beat up another guy. That's why the Midnight Express squash matches are generally works of art. Like in this case, Condry picks him up for a body slam and just kind of slams him towards the corner, Zayn that is, so he can tag Legon back into the ring. You get a funny Jim Cornette line picked up by the cameras there.
He's boy signed a contract to wrestle us a temporary insanity.
And some knees to the back of the neck to soften things up. And Condry finishes with a really nice looking brain buster that caused me to exclaim, "Oh!" as I'm watching it. That one looked really, really good there.
For over 50 years, the Jim Crockett Organization has insisted on presenting the finest in quality and exciting spectator entertainment. This highest standards of competition continues. We're pleased to announce the selection of the host city for the 1986 James Crockett Sr. Memorial Cup, and New Orleans, Louisiana was selected.
I'm not sure who that was that did the read for the Crockett Cup 86 coming to New Orleans, but that was the best take that they got out of all that. Yes, the first Crockett Cup, 1986, there was three of them, so 86, 87, and 88. The first one held in the Superdome in New Orleans on April 19th, 1986. Kind of fun, because you know how they choose WrestleMania now, and Vince McMahon has this obsession with outdrawing the Super Bowl. Well, the Crockett Cup in 1986 was held in the same building as the Super Bowl was held just weeks before. Super Bowl 20, which I'm sure you all remembered, if you were of a certain age, you were sitting down in front of the television, you watched as the New England Patriots accomplished many of their goals in that football game by keeping Walter Payton out of the end zone, despite losing by 36. And look, I was 6 years old. I went to bed when it was 3-0 and then was taken for a loop when I woke up and saw that it was 46-10, and also thinking, 46-10 doesn't sound like a real football score. And in fact, despite only being 6 years old at the time, I was correct, as 46-10 had only been a final score once before in NFL history. Back in November of 1923, the Canton Bulldogs defeated the Cleveland Indians, which I always loved back in the day when they used to just have, like, every team in the town have the exact same name. Like, the New York Giants, the Cleveland Indians, the St. Louis Cardinals. Like, there was absolutely no regard for any sort of trademarks or anything like that back then. So they are promoting here the upcoming show in Roanoke, Virginia on April 4th, a town which they would run monthly. Roanoke, not a place that I've been to ever, really. I may have driven through it once, but wholly unmemorable or anything like that. Black Bart starts out our cavalcade of promos here, and he'll be defending the Mid-Atlantic title against Sam Houston, who he had just beaten for the belt. Not a whole lot here from Black Bart. In one of an earlier Pro Wrestling Only podcast, and I think it was actually WorldCast, which if you're listening to my show, you should definitely listen to WorldCast, because they're taking world-class episodes from 1982 right now and reviewing them in a much more efficient manner than I am, because they're not talking about Super Bowl 20 or Pez dispensers or anything like that. And one of them on the show talked about how Black Bart is literally like the most generic name because he turns up in world class in 1982. But he is the Mid-Atlantic champion in early 1986. So, hey, I mean, it can't all be bad. But Sam Houston, he was so thin. I just never really bought him. Even as like an underdog babyface, he was just too thin. And he had lost the title to Black Bart very shortly before this. And then we get Tully in for his second promo of the show. We're not even halfway through and Tully is cutting a second promo here. He's taking on Wahoo McDaniel at the Roanoke show. And it had been a while since he'd been to Roanoke, is what he says. So clearly he's got nothing to say about the town or whatever. Unfortunately, he says Wahoo McDaniels, as in plural. So I don't know. I don't think this is a handicap match, Tully. You're not taking on more than one Wahoo. But Tully would, in fact, end up retaining the title, of course, at that show in Roanoke. Then we have Jim Cornette here. And the thing I like about Jim Cornette in this particular promo compared with when he came out with the Midnights earlier, he didn't have his glasses on. And Cornette, at least during this time period in the mid-80s, he's one of those guys who needed his glasses in order to kind of like frame his face. Otherwise, his eyes just look way too small. Kind of like on The Simpsons when Milhouse would take off his glasses and they'd be like these tiny little dots. Like, it just doesn't make sense. He needed to keep his glasses on. And because it is a Jim Cornette promo, I am going to play at least some of it.
Jim Cornette, by the way, you're going to be locked in a...
Oh, shut up, Tony. Hey, let me tell you something. I resent being put in a cage. I'm not the one that looks like a chipmunk. Tony, you do. You ought to be in a cage. The rock and roll ought to be in cages because there are a couple of animals. You saw what happened. I'm sure you were there last time in Roanoke. It was all kind of pandemonium. Everything was wild and woolly, but I did not interfere. The Rock and Roll Express says I did just as an excuse for all the little teeny bopper friends. But I tell you something, Rock and Roll, this is going to backfire on you, because if you stick me in a cage, there's no way I can get into that ring. And when the Midnight Express are beating your brains out and throttling your goozle pipe, I won't be able to save you.
Cornette says he managed his last match at a indie show last week. I believe it was WrestleCade. And there's nothing more permanent in the world of professional wrestling than somebody saying that they've done something for the last time. Magnum TA, the U.S. champion, follows up with a promo. And as I said earlier, his program with Nikita Koloff is well underway here. And his promo style is very intense. It's not quite Jake the Snake Roberts or anything like that. He's not that kind of talker. But he's very intense, and he will look, you will look into his eyes through the TV, and there's a certain seriousness to what he's saying. Just very, very intense all the way around. So I like it because it's more of the real style of promo that I certainly appreciate. But what is it about mustaches in the 1980s that just, like, all you had to do was grow a mustache, and, like, instantly you were just over like Rover. And I'm not even talking about Magnum TA. I'm talking about Magnum PI. I'm talking about, you know, Keith Hernandez. I'm talking about Hulk Hogan. I mean, the list goes on and on. It feels like the 80s was truly the decade of the mustache. Nikita, I need you so. There's no real reason for me to play Nikita by Elton John other than to say I would have rather have had Nikita Koloff in this next match than any of the four guys that we are going to see here. It is Rocky Kernodle, who is no Don Kernodle, I know that for sure, and the Italian Stallion taking on Thunderfoot and Leo Burke. Thunderfoot is actually Joel Deaton under a mask that makes him look like a conquistador. I don't know what I can really say about this or this match. I mean, Leo Burke is probably the most famous guy out of this match, and I know him most as being a star in Canada and Bret Hart talking about him in his book and talking about doing the Leo Burke finish, which, for those of you who don't know, it is the ending to SummerSlam 92 against Davey Boy Smith, where Bret Hart is on the wrong side of the kind of hooking the legs there that won the British Bulldog the Intercontinental title. Italian Stallion, he's been on Greetings from Allentown in the past. Of course, legendary spaghetti eater. Could eat a pound of spaghetti faster than any man in the world, it is said at one time. Thunderfoot is Joel Deaton, if I didn't already say that, and Rocky Kernodle here, who looks an awful lot like Dino Bravo if Bravo shrunk in the wash, which is certainly not a compliment by any means, but, you know, it is what it is. You get quick tags early on, and you can tell that not a lot of emphasis is going into this match because David and Tony are just talking about the Crockett Cup and, you know, how it's going to be in New Orleans, 24 tag teams. We're very excited about this tournament that's for $1 million or whatever. Thunderfoot slams Kernodle, but Kernodle actually grabs the arm and drags him down on his way down to the body slam. A leapfrog by Kernodle. He barely gets over on that leapfrog. We almost had a Dr. Death, Barry Windham, Starrcade 87 situation here with a severe groin injury or anything like that. Burke gets worked over for a bit, but then he tags out. But then Leo Burke, to connect him even more to Bret Hart, he does the Bret Hart Foundation transition spot where he hits the guy who's running the ropes as he's on the apron. So the Italian Stallion is now in peril, and you get a gut-wrench suplex by Burke, who I have to say is probably above this match in terms of the other guy. I mean, no disrespect to the other guys. I just think he's a bigger star than the others. And his time, you know, he never really did a whole lot during this particular run in Crockett. Kernodle tags back in, and he hits Thunderfoot with the exact same move that Pez Watley used to put away his opponent in the first match. So if Pez is watching this, he's probably getting even more angry if this was shot in order, which who knows when this was shot, because there's the history of WWE is a great website, but unfortunately with WCW and NWA tapings, it can be rather difficult. Like, when was this shot? Where was it shot? Like, nobody really knows. Like, I can't trace this match to anything. Burke ends up breaking up a pin, but then he gets hit with a double elbow. And Rocky puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran. And Thunderfoot, see, his thing was that he would load his boot. But in this case, it was so subtle that when I was watching it, I didn't notice. So good thing that they had a replay there to show him, you know, just kind of kicking the front of his boot into the mat. And he ends up getting a 3 count out of it. And I'm not entirely sure what the point of this was, but I am glad that Leo Burke went over here, since he's clearly the biggest star in the match here. And nobody around ringside... The thing you can say about Jim Crockett Promotions crowds in 1986 is they were red hot for everything. Certainly one of the best years for a promotion and their audience in terms of how into the product they were. And even they don't really give a crap what's going on here.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Greetings from Allentown. We'll be back after these messages.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer those to you on 3 great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Puri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
In addition to those shows, I want to give a shout out, of course, it's actually still mentioned because the commercial hasn't been changed yet, but the Our Vantage Point podcast, which is on their own feed right now, certainly give them a listen. And of course, the Sportscasters, hosted by Steve Bennett, a dear friend of the show and a Buffalo Sabres season ticket holder. So you should go listen to his show just for that, because if you're a Buffalo Sabres season ticket holder, you have sat through more than your fair share of cruddy hockey in the last 6 or 7 years. So do keep that in mind. Right now, we have Dusty Rhodes here for the promo. And Dusty, he often would get accused of, quote-unquote, acting too black, as it were. And this is in full effect right here because of what he calls Tully Blanchard, making him sound like he's George Jefferson or something.
You know, David, it's really astonishing to me, Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream, Tully Blanchard out here trying to be cool, you understand? I have never seen a white honky with a zoot suit hat walk around with dark shades trying to be cool. The brothers know what I'm talking about.
Seriously, what is up with Dusty there? It's like he is Sherman Helmsley as George Jefferson. By the way, I can't recommend The Jeffersons as a series highly enough. It holds up pretty much through the entire 10 years. Yeah, it gets a little silly at the end, and then you have the weird different Mike in the middle of the series. You have original Mike, and then he comes back later on, and then you have a fake one in the middle, kind of like fake Diesel and fake Kane. But yeah, it feels like Dusty is calling Tully Blanchard a honky, which is just among the strangest things ever. And this is during the Dusty baby doll period, where she's standing over his shoulder the entire time. And Dusty says that she's been named Lady of the Year by Better Mansions and Gardens. So carefully avoiding any sort of trademarks there. And her as a baby face is just so weird, because I just get an odd vibe by the way she looks at the camera during the promos. Even as Dusty's talking, it just really kind of, I don't know. All I can ever think about with Baby Doll is the fact that she got together with Sam Houston and presumably broke him in half, because Sam Houston is just so, so rail thin. Dusty wraps the promo by telling Jimmy Darvin that he's been doxxed without using that terminology.
That's why you talk about Baby Doll. That's why it's risky business now that the Indian is here. And Jimmy Garvin, me and Magnum told the Indian where you live.
You know, Dusty, as somebody who works in the office and probably has access to certain human resources materials at Jim Crockett Promotions, perhaps maybe you shouldn't be giving out people's home addresses that they have a blood feud with. I feel like that's particularly bad form. Next, they read off a list of teams that would be appearing in the 1986 Crockett Cup. I'm not going to read off all 24 teams that are in this tournament, but just going to call attention to a few notable ones, including the fabulous ones, Steve Kern and Stan Lane, in from Memphis. Of course, they were kind of all over the place. You had teams from Florida, Memphis, the UWF Mid-South, and of course from Jim Crockett Promotions. So this gave this a little bit more of a national flavor. And in fact, international flavor. Another team is Giant Baba and Tiger Mask, which I feel like is a very odd team, those two guys standing next to each other. Dino Bravo and Rick Martel, the two French-Canadian superstars of late 1980s WWF teaming up in the 86 Crockett Cup. You don't really think of them as meshing well as a team, but whatever, they're two guys from the province of Quebec. And one team that I found interesting, even though it made perfect sense because they were both members of Paul Jones' army, was the Barbarian and Baron Von Raschke. Because, of course, in a few years, when the Barbarian would jump to WWF alongside the Warlord, they would be managed by the Baron. Of course, Baron Von Raschke was under this hood the entire time, and you could never actually see him. And it was such a brief period that if you blinked, you missed it. But Baron Von Raschke is the manager of the Powers of Pain at SummerSlam 1988. So, you know, those two guys had a relationship going back here to the 86 Crockett Cup. Now we get Sharp Dressed Man playing as we get Jimmy Garvin as Precious, and once again sprays the aerosol leading the way, like as if somebody had taken a really horrific dump in a bathroom. Like, that's how much she's spraying ahead here. And he is taking on George South, who is certainly one of the most prominent Southern enhancement talents of all time. I think there should have been a Last Battle of Atlanta-style match between George South and Mike Jackson to see who is the king of the Southern job guys once and for all, and just make it a complete shoot, okay? Actually, make it the guy who lays down first actually wins the title. So it would be like in reverse or whatever. So Garvin here, of course, many time winner of the Billy Graham Award on Where the Big Boys Play. Certainly a podcast that has influenced me over time. It's just the way that both Parv and Chad would grow to hate him more and more and more as he entrenched himself as a Freebird. Garvin, of course, wearing the white trunks here. I mentioned it last week with Shane Douglas wearing those white, tidy whities. I guess, as a member of the Jimmy Garvin Appreciation Society. Garvin offers a handshake, or South, there's a handshake, but instead Garvin just sort of kicks him right away, and there's a backdrop, and then he finishes it really quickly with a brainbuster. These NWA squash matches sometimes are a little too short for my liking, because there's a certain period of time I like to talk about these guys, and they're not really giving me enough during the match, kind of like my complaint in that 88 show was that they didn't have time to do anything else during the match, like talk about the wrestler, talk about his feuds or whatever, because it would be over in 30 seconds. And as I said, yeah, that brainbuster that he had there, not as good as the one Condry had earlier in the show. So it kind of, you probably shouldn't have him doing that move at the same time or on the same show as Dennis Condry. But hey, what are you going to do?
With the Boogie Wee Man Jimmy Van and Pistol Pairs Wally.
Let me tell you something. Number one, baby. That's what it stands for. Jim Crockett Promotions.
Sometimes the main event of a show will happen when you don't even know it. When you've gone to take a whiz or you've gone to grab something to eat and something happens, you end up missing it. And it's like, oh, okay, they were going to put that in there. That's fine. We have Pez Whatley here, and he's talking great about Jim Crockett Promotions, as was very common in the interviews at the time. And Jimmy Valiant eventually makes his way into the frame. Now, before I get into what they're saying and really break this down, I have to explain what these two guys are wearing at the time. Pez is shirtless, but he is wearing what appears to me dress slacks, just kind of beige dress slacks with no belt, which is a very strange choice. I don't know why he's not wearing a shirt and just walking around shirt. I mean, Pez was never exactly Mr. Olympia or anything like that. Not the Mr. Olympia who wrestled, but, you know, in terms of his physique, his pants and tights were always kind of awkward looking at times. He would have a gut sometimes that would overhang his trunks, especially in his WWF enhancement period. And in comes Jimmy Valiant, who is wearing a shirt. And his tights, of course, are from the Terry Funk store of the stripes along the legs. But then when you get up to the main trunks, it's also striped too. But the stripes from the top don't necessarily line up with the stripes at the bottom. So you have this kind of odd looking effect, you know, whatever. And he is wearing a white shirt that says Weasel Slappers. And Weasel, of course, is in a reference to Paul Jones, who was also the Weasel, in addition to Bobby Heenan, which comes off as a bit of a ripoff, one of the other. I don't know which one came first in the end, because I don't know the Heenan exact history from the AWA or tracing Paul Jones all the way back through Jim Crockett Promotions or when people started yelling Weasel at him. So that's why Valiant has that shirt on. So Pez is talking about other stuff that's going on in the promotion. Dusty, Nikita, and all these other guys. And then Jimmy Valiant makes his way into the picture. And he's clapping, and he's just kind of shuffling to his right. And it's his turn to talk. And Pez is very excited. He looks so happy out there as Jimmy Valiant is starting to talk. And then we have our money moment.
Oh, right now! Oh, right now! Oh, right now!
Jones! Build that army, baby! Because Davy Crockett, right here, is the best black athlete in the world! Pistol Pez Whatley, my brother!
Okay, there's a lot to cover here. I want to start with Crockett, because I always enjoy whenever they would call him Davy Crockett instead of David Crockett. Makes me wonder, is there any footage from JCP of David Crockett actually wearing a coonskin cap? And am I the only person who really cares to see that as we go? So Pez is kind of interrupted there. Jimmy comes in, he's doing his clapping act. And Pez is still pretty happy there. He's kind of shucking and jiving, standing next to him as Valiant is talking. Until he gets to that line where he calls Pez the greatest black athlete in the world. Which is a peculiar thing to say. Because why would you say that somebody is the best fill-in-any-race athlete? Because it kind of comes off as offensive. But we know that Jimmy Valiant means well. You know, he's not trying to be racist or anything. Or at least, I don't think he's trying to be racist as a babyface. I mean, I certainly don't think that's the intention. But let's take Jimmy Valiant at face value here. Was Pez Whatley, at this point in March of 1986, the best black athlete in the world? So let's go around the world of sports for that time in 1986 and see if we can name a few athletes who are better. And I've actually compiled just a few of them who may rank ahead of Pez Whatley. I'm thinking Dwight Gooden. They're about to start the 1986 baseball season. He had won 24 games the season before with an ERA under 2. So I think that Pez is probably ahead of Dwight Gooden. Not ahead of Dwight Gooden, that is. Same for Daryl Strawberry in the prime of his career with the New York Mets. Of course, they would win the World Series against the Red Sox in 86 there. Michael Jordan was hurt for much of the 1986 season. It's a year that's really not talked about in his career until you get to his 63-point performance against the Celtics in the playoffs. But that wouldn't happen until after this. So I'm going to remove him from the equation. Magic Johnson, they were the defending NBA champions at that point, 1986. He had won the MVP of the league, previously an NBA Finals MVP in 1980. He probably edges Pez Watley, even though in 86 they lost to the Rockets in five games and didn't show up for their beating against the Celtics in the 86 Finals. Isaiah Thomas, he was still coming along at that time in his fifth season with the Pistons. However, I'd probably still rank him above Pez Watley on a list of greatest athletes from the spring of 86. Grant Fuhr, the goaltender for the Edmonton Oilers, even though the Oilers did not win the Cup in 1986, he was the starting goaltender, or at least we get the majority of the starts, the previous 2 years when they did win the Stanley Cup. So Grant Fuhr, better athlete than Pez Watley. Then we get into the world of football here. And I know I probably left people out like Kareem, but I'm not going to cover every single athlete here. Lawrence Taylor, Walter Payton, Mike Singletary. The latter two had just won the Super Bowl with the Bears, and Lawrence Taylor was in his mid-20s and just wreaking havoc on quarterbacks across the National Football League. Carl Lewis, also mentioned in episode 20 for his amazing national anthem at a Bulls-Nets game in 1993. He won gold medals at the 84 Olympics. And I'm sure he was doing something between the 84 and 88 Olympics. Debbie Thomas, figure skater. She would eventually compete for the U.S. in 1988 Olympics in Calgary. And she didn't win the gold medal there because Katarina Witt was a force of nature. Jackie Joyner-Kersee, the best female heptathlete in the world. And then there was Cheryl Miller, who was the best women's college basketball player at the time and was actually nominated for the Sullivan Award, which is given in the United States to the most outstanding amateur athlete. So at the end of the day here, I don't think Pez is taking umbrage necessarily with what Jimmy Valiant said. Well, let me try and explain this, because this is one of those things where you watch the clip of it and you're like, well, how the hell did that happen? But there's a deeper explanation here. And there really wasn't too much of a build from what I could gather to what was going to happen here. Paul Jones on the World Championship Wrestling show the week before had said that he would have a surprise the next week. Well, this would be the surprise, which would indicate that this was a sort of premeditated thing. So why is Pez all friendly with Jimmy Valiant right then, and then all of a sudden turns on him the way it is? Is it a Ole Anderson ingratiate himself with Dusty Rhodes so he can get close to him and then attack him when his guard is down? I don't think that's the case here, because it happens so suddenly and it stops on a dime. So let me give you my theory of the Pez Watley heel turn on Jimmy Valiant. It is my belief, after doing some reading and research on this sort of thing, that Pez was a Manchurian candidate for Paul Jones' army. I believe at one time Pez was captured by Paul Jones' army and was taken behind closed door for a period of time, and either hypnotized or brainwashed or some just unholy combination of both. They're really kind of separate concepts, in that hypnosis, you can't force somebody through hypnosis to do something that they believe is necessarily intrinsically wrong. You know, you can't hypnotize somebody and then tell them to go rob a bank. That's where you get into brainwashing. So what I believe is that Paul Jones, having now formed this army, has decided to get into the business of brainwashing. And their candidate here was Pez Watley, because they knew they could get him in a position near Jimmy Valiant. And the way it would work, and this is how it would work in The Manchurian Candidate, the movie from 1962. There was a book in 1959 before that. And of course, it was parodied on The Simpsons, which is probably the easiest way to reference this to a modern audience. Not using the 2004 movie, because really nobody remembers that. But we should remember on The Simpsons, where Sideshow Bob captured and brainwashed / hypnotized Bart and loaded him with plastic explosives and told him to approach Krusty the Clown on the stage when he would say, I never had such a great audience. So it's something like a trigger word to trigger the brainwashed subject into doing what you want them to do. So what I believe is that Paul Jones and his army used the word black athlete, or the phrase black athlete, waiting for Jimmy Valiant to say that phrase, knowing that eventually down the road he wasn't going to be able to help himself and was going to put over Pez Watley as the greatest black athlete in the world. And then when that would happen, Pez would then attack Jimmy Valiant and cut off his ponytail. Now, this all seems really absurd, but when you watch the way Watley acts during this promo, when you hear the words black athlete, he all of a sudden stops dancing and just turns his head towards Valiant, like almost like a robot there. And Valiant, of course, he's again doing the clapping and shucking thing across. That's kind of the best part of this, is Jimmy Valiant just kind of saying it. And then he's going back to the camera too, so you get to see Jimmy Valiant's giant ass. It's one of the largest asses for a guy that size. I mean, pound for pound, Jimmy Valiant's ass is right up there with Rikishi. I mean, for Rikishi, he's 400 and something pounds, so he's going to have a large ass. Yokozuna, all that. But for a guy who's in the mid-200s, that is a monstrous ass that Jimmy Valiant... You could show drive-in movies on that, if drive-in movies still existed. So Watley, having now been triggered by that word, headbutts Jimmy Valiant, and the beatdown is now on. And David Crockett, he's concerned about this, but he's not too concerned. He kind of tries to put an arm in and gets shoved away. I mean, he's done this drill before. There have been people attacked in the interview segment, and he's not going to get too involved.
What are you doing?
It is at this point that Pez reaches into his pocket, and he has a little bit of trouble because he's wearing slacks, and sometimes you can't get the hand in the pocket all the way, and Pez doesn't exactly have the smallest derriere either. So he has a little trouble getting it out, and he pulls out a scissors. And when he pulls out the scissors, now David Crockett and the people in the studio audience there are very concerned about what is going to happen. And as he beats down Valiant, he grabs him by the ponytail and shears it off of his head as everybody screams in such a way that you would think that Pez was murdering him. You would think it was Bobby Kennedy being shot in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. Which, by the way, I watched the video of that whole scene right before this to kind of compare the two. And you know, I guess with RFK's assassination, people didn't necessarily know or could see what was going on. They could only hear gunshots. But the reaction to this, you would think that something similar was going on when the man was just getting a trim. And Jimmy Valiant, he had a lot of hair at all times, which, of course, is why he would be in so many hair matches. And Paul Jones, before it was incorporated as an army, let's say, back in 1984, it cut off his beard when he was tied in the ropes. And of course, that beard grew back because Jimmy Valiant, he had a beard that was to the point where he was always ready to play for the Stanley Cup. That's a tradition in hockey, is that guys grow beards all through the playoffs. And whenever you get to the point in the playoffs where the team wins the Stanley Cup, everybody on the team has Jimmy Valiant beards because they've been growing them for 2 months. So he would put up his hair a lot, and the idea was to take Jimmy Valiant's hair would be to take some of his soul. But the real question here is, and this has been asked by so many people, why did Pez Watley have a scissors on him at the time? Why is he carrying a scissors around in the back pocket of his dress pants? It would certainly make it uncomfortable to sit down if you have a scissors on your ass. And I think there are some explanations here, one of which is that Jim Crockett Promotions, notable for very, you know, hot angles and good wrestling action, but they also had a very good arts and crafts program backstage. And Pez Whatley was extremely involved in that. And, you know, in his other pocket, he actually had sparkles and glue. So, you know, you got to have a scissors around if you want to do that. That might not be so likely. Why is he carrying a scissors? As part of the Paul Jones brainwashing operation, of course they want some of Jimmy Valiant's hair, so they instruct him, whenever you're wearing pants, because if he's wearing trunks, you can't carry the scissors around. But when you're wearing pants, Pez, he has been brainwashed to carry around a scissors, just in case Jimmy Valiant says, black athlete, and then he can be triggered to cut off Jimmy Valiant's ponytail. I mean, that's the explanation I can think of. I don't know. So the beatdown is continuing. I'll tell you who, black boy, and yelling at him. And the transformation of Pez Whatley into this heel has begun. And it's really crazy. In the coming weeks, his promos would be over the top crazy. And our pal, Joe Nighthawk Coltrane, would show up a couple of weeks later on Worldwide and would try to talk to his friend Pez, saying that he tried to call him 1,000 times. And he offers him some money, saying, do you need some money here? So he gives Pez a little bit of money, who accepts it. Pez is going to be transforming into Shaska Whatley after this. He's going to change his name as he joins Paul Jones's army. So he takes the money from Coltrane, and this is what he says.
Here, you need some money? Take it. Because you ain't got no business here with these guys, man. They nothing, man.
What?
They ain't nothing, man.
Well, thank you, brother.
That's one of the all-timers again, right there, where he hands him some money and just says, well, thank you, brother, and then sucker punches him right in the face. You notice that David Crockett, if you look up Joe Coltrane, Pez Whatley, it'll bring you, it's from the April 19th episode of Worldwide, so 3 weeks after this aired. Crockett is still calling him Pez instead of Shaska, so it's kind of like, you know, Floyd Patterson calling Muhammad Ali Cassius Clay before their fight, and then, of course, Ali taunting him with what's my name during the bout. So yes, this would build up that Valiant Paul Jones army feud again, and hair would be flying off people's heads all through 1986, starting here at the Great American Bash. You had a kind of 50-50 haircut thing where at one of the Bash shows Jimmy Valiant gets his head shaved, which is very dramatic because there's a lot of hair there, and then later Shaska gets his head shaved, finally leading up to a match at Starrcade where you have the hair of Paul Jones against the hair of Big Mama, which would be Jimmy Valiant's second wife in reality. And of course, Paul Jones ended up getting his head shaved there. And as you roll into 87, the whole thing kind of fades away. But certainly for anybody watching Jim Crockett Promotions in the mid-1980s, this is one of the feuds, because it just went on and on and on, and there's so many memorable moments. And I gotta say, this one right here might take the cake for just how random and out of nowhere it is, and for just how the people act on screen, and for Pez being shirtless and wearing I couldn't tell what shoes he was wearing. I wish I could identify it, because they looked like kind of fancy-ish shoes, it seemed. But, oh my God, Pez Whatley carrying around a scissors in his dress slacks. My goodness.
I'll tell you, black boy, I'll let you throw
such a big angle there can be a shock to the system. We go right to our next match, which is Ron Garvin against Mike Simiani or whatever. It really doesn't matter because they don't really introduce the guys on screen here. And Tony is on commentary here, along, of course, David Crockett, I guess, rejoins Tony in the booth for this Ron Garvin match. But David, he's so out of sorts from the Jimmy Valiant incident, he doesn't even say anything, and you can barely even hear him. Now, maybe they had audio problems, but I choose to believe that David Crockett was so despondent by what had taken place in front of him and his failure to act. He could have prevented something from happening there, but he kind of stood down. So right now, he's announcing a Ron Garvin match, which if you watch the World Championship Wrestling shows on the network, anytime there's a Ron Garvin squash match, David Crockett practically has the verbal equivalent of an erection going for the entire time. But here, he is so subdued, and it's noticeable because Tony's trying to talk to him, and David Crockett is not talking back. It's almost as if, like, a person went from watching vivisection to watching porn, like, in the span of, like, 5 minutes. That's what David Crockett is probably feeling right now. He has seen something horrifying, but now he is watching something that gives him great pleasure, but it's not giving him great pleasure because of, you know, what had happened before. The memory has lingered on. So anyway, Hands of Stone Ronnie Garvin finishes him off in virtually no time at all. There's really no other moves to speak of there. And yes, it did finish the match with a right hand, and I endorse it for whatever reason, because it is kind of fun when Ron Garvin does it, in part because you usually get David Crockett showing such great joy at Ron Garvin beating the hell out of some jobber. So we'll just move along. More promos for the show in Roanoke. And this time, Tony is behind a metal fence, which is a trope that I always enjoy when they would do for promos to promote a steel cage match coming up. In the WWF, it was most famously done for the No Holds Barred, the match, the movie from late 1989 with Randy Savage and Sherry and Zeus all doing very interesting things, which I have a feeling that I might be doing a show on that coming up. I'm just saying. But I've also seen Angelo Mosca doing one of those on an early 1984 version of Maple Leaf Wrestling that is on YouTube. I think it's labeled January 21st. And he had a cage match against, I want to say, Sergeant Slaughter, which struck me as weird because of how Slaughter was already in the WWF. Kind of an odd arrangement before the WWF took over Toronto in the middle of 1984. And what they're saying is that the cage match in Roanoke was going to be between Magnum and Nikita Koloff. However, that's not listed on the history of WWE.com. So I don't know if that's something that might be missing or whatever, because there's nothing here listed for a cage match per se, but no big deal there. You get a promo from the Koloffs, and Nikita is looking pretty sharp as they're gearing up for the Crockett Cup. Very sharp in a white number with a red collar. You can tell that Nikita is not a baby face because nobody attacks him and he doesn't bleed all over his white shirt. Nikita, very famous, of course, for being so committed to kayfabe that he would actually change his name to Nikita Koloff and would talk in the accent the entire time, which would piss off some of the boys in the back because it's like, all right, we're behind closed doors here. You can drop the Russian thing now. You can act like the guy from Minnesota that you're supposed to be. But we're going right back to the ring. We have the television champion, Arn Anderson, taking on Mark Fleming. And I'm sorry, Mark, you're not going to get a bio treatment here because the show is running a little bit long. And this match only lasts about a minute, but it's actually very interesting and very instructive for what Arn Anderson was really, really good at, not only as a tag worker, but as a singles worker as well. Immediately, he goes to work, like, literally the bell rings, and he goes to work on the guy's left arm, like, with absolute precision, and he's a complete assassin. He gets him on the mat, he drops some knees on the arm, he did arm wringer. He picks him up for a body slam, but makes sure to slam him on the left arm. And then quickly he puts him in an armbar, not exactly a UFC-style armbar, but the same one that finished off Bobby Eaton at WrestleWar 92. Not the best-looking thing in the world. But Fleming, he's so tired of getting beaten down for these last 55 seconds by Arn Anderson that he submits to this armbar, even though with his other arm he could have reached the ropes. So this is the case of Arn being so dominant here that the guy gave up rather than continue when he could have reached the ropes. So kudos to you, Arn Anderson. Fun little squash match under 1 minute.
Why did you do it? Why?
I ain't through either. No, I ain't through. Let me tell you, Jimmy Valiant, everybody been trying to do a little bit of this, but I got the job done.
So yes, David Crockett is back with Pez Watley, who has the little ponytail there, and he's showing it off. And he says that I got the job done, which lends more credence the way he's talking to my brainwashing theory of him being captured at some point by Paul Jones's army and unleashed at an appropriate time. If you want to play a drinking game that'll really knock you on your ass, take a drink anytime Pez Watley says, "Let me tell you," to either start a sentence or in the course of any of his promos here. They didn't show the replay of what happened earlier, which is good because I want to point out something that Pez did that was very, very smart. He does his damage, and then you have the other baby faces come out to kind of clean things up there. And instead of running away, he slowly just kind of moves away. So he knows enough not to run with scissors, the old thing that we've learned in our childhood here. Before he leaves the interview area here, there is what he kind of gets in a little bit of a catchphrase there that I like.
Plenty of time in 85, but it's plenty of tricks in 86.
Sadly, that wasn't a catchphrase that really stuck around for Mr. Watley there. And that's the end of the show, pretty much. But what they do is they start rolling the credits, as they would do in Jim Crockett Promotions, as they show a slow motion of the beatdown of Jimmy Valiant. And I gotta tell you, more shows need this. Yeah, WWF never had closing credits the way they would do in Jim Crockett Promotions and later in WCW. This is very much like one of my favorite sitcom things, where they do the credits at the end of the show as the closing theme plays, like I had before with Family Ties at the top of this show. And they would show you highlights of things that happened in the episode as the music played. And that's what they're showing here with the Jimmy Valiant thing. It's like on sitcoms back in the day, you know, you'd watch it, the 22 minutes or whatever, and you digest it all. And you have this nice little recap at the end to tell you, oh yeah, Webster did this, or Alex Keaton did this, or, you know, you get to see the guys on Chips smiling at each other or whatever in like a still photo. Or like, did I see Gary Coleman on top of Muhammad Ali's shoulders as Ali answered the phone? Like, yes, that actually happened on an episode of Different Strokes. So, very nice of Jim Crockett Promotions. They don't get any credit for their production because it was certainly lousy at times, but a round of applause for them on that, to do that thing with the closing credits. I must salute them there. Still have one piece of business to attend to here, and it's another exciting edition of YouTube Comment Theater. There are quite a few comments on this particular video, which is over 10,000 views this time, which is going to lead to a lot of comments. Courtney West says, Dusty calling Tully a honky was great.
You want to borrow my hanky?
No, I never borrow a hanky from a honky.
You know, that white guy from the Jeffersons played one of the downtrodden stockbrokers in the movie Wall Street, so just keep it in mind next time you see that movie. Vaniel Morrow says, what, Pez didn't know he was black? And that's another theory of Pez Watley, is that he didn't actually know his race, and he thought he was a white guy. Kind of like the Dave Chappelle blind white supremacist skit from the first season of the Chappelle Show. Blood Legion says, 30 years ago when this first happened with Pez and Jimmy, I was laughing my ass off. 30 years later, I watch it again, and I'm still laughing my ass off. And yeah, you can't help but laugh at that. Lighthouse 6 says, the best evidence that Nighthawk was terrible on the mic. He made David Crockett sound like Shakespeare. Yeah, luckily David was there to kind of bail him out. Not that it helped a whole hell of a lot, but, you know, what are you going to do? Aaron Snyder says, Joe Nighthawk Coltrane cut the absolute worst promo I've ever heard. It's comically bad. And yeah, that is why I love watching these shows, so I can come across random things like that. EMF says, I have zero recollection of Joe Coltrane, and I watched religiously. Yes, a very forgettable guy, not around at any point really other than the spring of 1986. Richard Walsh says, that had to be the only TV victory for Leo Burke and Thunderfoot. That must be how he got the name Thunderfoot. J. Kenny 2 says, God, I miss 80s wrestling. Yeah, I think we all do. There was a little thing on Twitter earlier this week about, do you watch old stuff as a rejection of new stuff, or do you watch new stuff now, but is the old stuff a sort of comfort food? I see it as sort of a comfort food. I mean, yeah, I don't watch now and consume everything the way I do the old stuff, but the other thing is, there's a lot of old stuff out there that I haven't necessarily seen, so it's always part of that continuous adventure. And finally, Heard, with three R's there, says, so Pez is upset that Jimmy called him the world's greatest black athlete, so he joins Paul Jones' army as an Amos and Andy-esque character named Shaska. And yes, there are a number of different issues with the Shaska Watley character perhaps being a different type of African-American stereotype, but perhaps I'll get into that if I do a show from Jim Crockett Promotions further into 1986. And that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. Now for next week's show. Of course, I've grown quite fond of WCW Prime lately. These deep C and even D shows where silliness reigns supreme. And I've been looking for ones for the WWF. Of course, there was plenty of silliness on TNT. I don't want to quite go back to that yet. So I have a new show that I could take a look at, or at least a new type of show, WWF Wrestling Spotlight. I'll be looking at the one from December 16th, 1989. And this is hosted by Ian Mooney, not Sean Mooney, but Ian Mooney. There's a very important difference there. And Sensational Sherry is alongside at this time. And they are promoting the No Holds Barred, the match, the movie that would be coming up later in December. And matches on this show include the Hart Foundation, the Bolsheviks of all teams. Nikolai Volkoff was gone for a little bit in 1989, but he is back teaming with Boris Zukov. The Big Boss Man during the short-lived ball and chain era, instead of just handcuffing guys to the ropes, he had an actual ball and chain with him, but he runs afoul of Dusty Rhodes and a fan in the front row. You probably know where I'm going with that. And our feature bout is Mr. Perfect against Bushwhacker Butch. Yes, that was the feature bout on an episode of WWF Spotlight in 1989. And plenty of promos for that No Holds Barred, the match, the movie, including Savage, Zeus, and Sherry behind the cage, as I mentioned earlier, that I love so much. So thank you all so much for listening. Spread the word about Greetings from Allentown as much as you can. Leave a review on iTunes. 5 stars, always appreciated for both me and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. So do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
My brother!